Hey, hello again. Welcome everyone to another Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshinworks. As global interconnectedness deepens, understanding geopolitical risk has become absolutely mission critical for innovation, operations, international collaboration, and economic development. The traditional approaches, as we've talked about many times, the traditional approaches to operating and indeed to analyzing political, technological, and security factors in isolation is no longer sufficient in our increasingly interconnected, complex, rapidly evolving world. So today, we're going to be exploring how geopolitical intelligence can be reframed through an ecosystemic lens, examining the interconnected dynamics that shape global stability and operations. Today, we're going to investigate how the four pillars of modern geopolitical risk, i.e. the balance of power, technology, climate change, and the nature of warfare, actually create both challenges and opportunities for industry, policy, and society. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshinworks, and joined today by our guest, Dr. Nicholas Kenny, founder of Beacon Geopolitical Intelligence. Nick, let's start. Let's kick things off with your journey from law and academia to pioneering a systems-based approach to geopolitical risk assessment. Can you share a little bit of your background with our listeners?
Yes. First of all, I'd just like to thank you, Diane. Thanks for having me as a guest. I'm really honored. And a little bit about my background. Yes, as you mentioned, I started off in the law as an attorney. I have a passion still for constitutional law, and I've kind of brought that into my methodology in assessing geopolitical risk. But really what started me on my journey was 9/11. So I was just starting out as an attorney. And when 9/11 happened, I just had a passion to understand the root causes of that event and its impacts and the national security policy dimension and how those risks can be understood and mitigated in the future. And that brought me actually to work in Jerusalem for about a year, working on track two and track one and a half diplomacy there between Palestinians, Jordanians, and Israelis. I can talk some more about that maybe later in the podcast. And then went to work for the Defense Department, helping them stand up a new program for special operations forces as they were being deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq to help them understand the context of geopolitics and that they were working within. And then I've been teaching complex systems for about 7 years at a disruptor university, Minerva University, based out of Silicon Valley, San Francisco area. And they really embody the curriculum that I think you were kind of talking about with Martin Koosman in your last episode, you know, that educational challenge of de-siloing academia. This is what Minerva is all about. And the course that's required for all students that is actually called Complex Systems. And I brought a lot of that thinking also into my geopolitical risk analysis and starting my own firm and continuing my research interests, which, as you mentioned, are along the lines of those four pillars: the balance of power, the nature of war, technology, and climate change. So yeah, that's a little bit about my journey. I look forward to talking to you more on the podcast.
Yeah, fascinating journey. And I look forward to kind of double clicking into a lot of those facets as we proceed. Let's maybe start with those four pillars, right? You've developed a framework that views geopolitical risk through those four interconnected pillars: balance of power, technology, climate change, and warfare. What led you to realize that these siloed approaches to geopolitical analysis were insufficient, and that we needed to create a more prismatic approach to understanding and navigating?
Yeah, I think, you know, teaching that course, Complex Systems, at Minerva, I think was a big part of kind of realizing that in order to understand geopolitics, you really need to take a systemic and complex systems approach. And also, again, going back to my journey in terms of understanding 9/11, it's really a complex story about what led to that event, that dramatic, violent event. And it's much more than thinking about one part of the system. I think if we were to contrast ecosystemic thinking or systemic thinking with kind of the traditional analytical industrial type thinking, we would focus on a particular part and assign causal responsibility to that particular part. But systems thinking, I think, understands not just the different parts of the geopolitical system, but how they relate. You keep saying interconnected. I think that is the key word here, right? Is how are they interconnected? How are they related to each other? How are those relationships, which aren't always cooperative and can sometimes be violent, right? How are those relationships defining properties in the system? So that's kind of what led me to understand that there has to be a more systemic approach. And I think in studying national security policy through the global war on terror and post 9/11, I think it's also important to understand just kind of the processes that the U.S. government and its coalition forces were engaged in, right, were much more broad-based than just the military dimension. Right? We're talking about an economic, a social, a cultural, and to some extent, the failure to understand the scale and ambition of those dimensions, I think, can account for some of the shortcomings in what the U.S. did in Afghanistan and Iraq. So that's the other part of it, is kind of thinking about not just the kinetic, violent parts of war, but what's going on socially, economically, culturally around geopolitical competition, violent or otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's such an important analogy. And, you know, the folks in industry that are listening to us today, you know, their frame for uncooperative actors might be their competitors, right, in a market, right? Yeah. You have a very different and much kind of more profound, punctuated landscape of uncooperative actors, right, in those examples that you provided. So I'd love to maybe spend a little bit more time with that. So your work spans, as you mentioned, from special operations with the Defense Department to Silicon Valley startups. Mm-hmm. And maybe take us deeper into how this diverse experience has shaped your understanding of how geopolitical risks manifest a little bit differently across sectors, and how an ecosystemic approach might matter both for national security, but also commercial operations, right? Regardless of what sector an organization might be operating in.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, so geopolitical risk does operate differently across different domains, right, and different sectors. So let's start with Silicon Valley in terms of kind of focusing on technology. So I think one way to understand the geopolitical dimension of the technology sector or Silicon Valley is understanding kind of the negative externalities that are caused by rapid innovation. In your last episode, I think with Martin, you mentioned like social media, and now we have the oncoming onslaught of AI, right? And I think risks start to escalate when there isn't a focus on the negative externalities, second and third order, that could occur due to rapid technological innovation. So what do I mean by that? So for instance, in the social media space, I think there was a vast underestimation of the role that social media could play in polarizing democratic societies, right?
Yeah.
And that's not to say that social media hasn't been a boon, a huge benefit, a massive blessing to society. What I'm saying is that the political risks, I think, were underappreciated and not prepared for because there was so much emphasis on that positive aspect of democratizing information, right? And so I love this line from Thomas Friedman. He says, you know, bad actors are usually early adopters. And I think that's what we need to be thinking about when it comes to AI, is that the actors that are going to be pushing the frontier are not necessarily the actors who we want to be pushing that frontier. They're going to be acting very quickly to figure out how to leverage AI for the interests and preferences and priorities that they have, whether that's criminal organizations, militias, insurgents, terrorists, or other states. So I think that's one way to kind of think about geopolitical risk in terms of Silicon Valley and the negative externalities that it can generate. And then in the public sector, I think what my work focuses on is how we need to really change how we're thinking about state competition at the geopolitical level. So in my work, I teach a lot of Clausewitz and Sun Tzu. So some of your listeners might be familiar with them. Sun Tzu is often, for instance, used in the business community. You got to think about how to design strategy against your competitors. We can talk more about whether or not I find that really applicable. But I think the point is that those two thinkers are fundamental thinkers for understanding how states strategize, not just in the violent aspects of war, but more generally. And so if we break down the system, traditionally, we would break it down in terms of the government, the military, and the people. But I think what we have to layer on top of that in the 21st century is technology. Is Clausewitz and Sun Tzu really lived in a time where technology was not changing that fast.
Right.
And because of that, they didn't really need to take account of it as a factor. So Clausewitz had a trinity of the government, military, and the people. But I would say that you now need a quartet. You need to think about that fourth layer and that layer of innovation, and thinking about innovation again as having both negative and positive effects in the geopolitical space. And that's what you see, I think, in the mainstream media. It tends to kind of demonize technology as something that's disrupting society and breaking norms, or it tends to lionize technology as the end-all be-all that has all solutions. That neither one of those answers is correct, I would say, in understanding geopolitical dynamics. You have to understand how it's having this mixture of both positive and negative effects. And a lot of my work focuses on kind of how the law, bringing in my law background, right, can kind of mitigate the negative effects and leverage the positive effects. Because what's really interesting is that legal and political institutions change really, really slowly. They're just not structured for innovation. But technology, particularly in capitalist societies, is structured for rapid change and innovation. And the gap between the pace of reform in those two domains is what's driving a lot of risk, I would say, in geopolitics today.
No doubt. Yeah, I think there's so much to unpack in what you just shared with us. I think one of the challenges that we continue to grapple with, as I think you've also noted in our series, is just the increasing chasm between kind of the pace of innovation, the pace of adoption, and then the pace of regulation. Mm-hmm. There seems to be, depending on, you know, the sector, the capability, an increasing chasm. And the more that policy lags, mm-hmm. The shape and form and direction, the vector of innovation, the more you can get these reactionary kind of catch-up movements by the policy reform, which can be abrupt for the adoption layer, right? And so the more that you can kind of align those three waves as change rolls through industry, policy, and society, I think the better fitting we're going to have between the benefits that we're looking for with the innovation and the safeguards that we have in the policy reform. I think one of the kind of unsung heroes and villains of kind of what we're experiencing here is this sublayer, right? We have a layer of information and a layer of incentive structures that also shape a lot of how we experience change, right, in society, industry, and policy. And to your earlier point, the information with the technologies, information has also been weaponized, right? And access to information or the integrity of information can shape perceptions and experiences and access. So it's it is a necessarily a great opportunity for systems design as we think about how we experience innovation and these new technologies, but it necessitates kind of an additional layer of thoughtfulness as we adopt these new technologies that have so much potential for benefit. Maybe if we double click into just an example, this is a recent example and one that many of our listeners will be familiar with just through the headlines. But the nature of warfare has evolved pretty dramatically, as we've seen in Ukraine and Gaza here recently. So maybe how are these changing conflict patterns affecting the way that we think about technology, innovation, and geopolitical relations? What should organizations, societies, and policymakers be anticipating as warfare continues to evolve? There is an acutely different kind of shape to warfare in these two examples.
Yeah, great question. And if I could just circle back to something you touched on, Diane, about kind of the backlash when the pace of legal and political reform falls behind technological innovation. So I think that's a great, great point, is that it's not just a difference in pace. It's that when legal and political institutions suddenly wake up, oftentimes, as you're suggesting, they overcorrect or they don't actually innovate to, again, mitigate those negative externalities and leverage the positive externalities. So I just want to point that out, that you're layering on, I think, a nice subtle point that it's not just that the pace is slow in one case and fast in another, but sometimes legal and political institutions, in a rush to catch up, they overcorrect. They kind of outpace innovation and actually then start to, for instance, there's some talk of, you know, slowing the pace of innovation in AI or stopping people from using AI. You know, that to me would be an overcorrection. But back to your excellent question about the nature of war. So first of all, you mentioned distinctions between those wars, and I do think there are a lot of distinctions, but if I could just focus on one similarity that I think a lot of your listeners would kind of find interesting. So in the history of war, oftentimes you see three basic strategies, okay? So those are strategies of maneuver, where your armies are trying to outmaneuver and get a superior position to the opposition and win that way. There's strategies of attrition. You've probably heard of these. Strategies of attrition are about wearing down the enemy's material and manpower. Okay. And then there's strategies of exhaustion. Like those strategies are strategies to kind of make the enemy incapable of economically and socially supporting the war. So strategic bombing of factories, for instance, would be part of a strategy of exhaustion. But I think what you see both in Gaza and in Ukraine is what I would categorize as kind of strategies of budgetary exhaustion. So what do I mean by that? I mean that all wars today, I would argue, are asymmetric, even wars between states. So traditionally, theorists would say, well, an interstate war is a symmetric war because both sides generally have conventional weapons that are somewhat similar, even if one side is weaker than the other. But I would argue, even in the interstate war of Ukraine versus Russia, that's an asymmetric war, and Ukraine is pushing the frontier of using a cemetery, right, to wear down Russia in terms of its budget. What do I mean by that? I mean, for instance, that they're using very low cost items or as low cost items as they can, for instance, drones, to destroy very, very expensive platforms on the Russian side.
Right.
A famous right. operation that was deep inside Russia to destroy some of the Russian bomber fleet. Right. So that was in terms of the actual equipment used, it was a few thousand dollars. In terms of, or maybe tens of thousands of dollars, but a very low magnitude percentage-wise compared to the millions or billions of rubles that they destroyed. Now, if you can scale that kind of asymmetry, right, you make it impossible financially for the other side to continue the war. And we're actually seeing that also with Israel. In my contacts with Israelis in the defense side, when they're facing Hezbollah and Hamas and their rockets, oftentimes they're faced with this dilemma. They know where the rockets are, and they know those rockets are about to be fired in Israel. But they have to think about how much they want to spend to destroy those rockets, because those rockets are generally much less expensive than the ordnance Israel is using to destroy them or detect them and prevent them from being launched into Israel. And Israel has to think about the long-term sustainability, budgetary-wise, about using their technology, which is much superior, to destroy rockets that may or may not cause casualties or damage in Israel, but are still a violation of its sovereignty and need to be stopped. So that's a key similarity, and I don't think that is going to go away. For instance, if there's a war in the China between China and the U.S. and the Taiwanese Strait, I think it's pretty clear that China is going to use an asymmetric strategy. They are going to be trying to use anti-access and area denial technology, which is a fancy way of saying anti-ship missiles and other technology, to destroy some of these very, very expensive naval platforms that the U.S. has. Of course, the most expensive is a carrier, and they'll potentially target a carrier with comparatively low cost ordnance. And there's no way that an actor can sustain that kind of financial loss without facing some serious trade-offs down the road about how to kind of replenish that loss, right? So I think similarity is really important, that we're seeing the emergence, I would say, of a new strategy. It's not really exhaustion, because you're not undermining the economic ability of the country to wage war, right? And it's not really attrition, because you're not necessarily wearing down their manpower and materiel. And it's not necessarily maneuver, because it's not about position. It's about selecting targets that are high cost to the enemy and with low cost capabilities on your side. And if you can do that over time, and I would say Ukraine is relatively successful right now of doing this over time, you can make it very difficult for the other side to continue the war. So that's a key similarity. Okay. So, and then in terms of the differences, one is, you have, it's the Ukraine-Russia war is an interstate war, and they have Ukraine. They have, the highest end technology and have their own conventional forces, uniformed, a chain of command. Whereas in Gaza, you have in Hamas, you have an unconventional enemy, terrorist or insurgent force, that does not have a traditional chain of command, does not have a stable set of supply and logistics, and just is much weaker. And because of that weakness, I would say they're leveraging a lot of the legal framework of the law of war to their advantage just to survive, right? In terms of their embeddedness in the civilian population, not being uniform, being very, very hard to find and eliminate within Gaza. So I think that, you know, that is a key difference. And then in terms of your point about weaponizing information, I would argue that the information war in Gaza is much more prominent and central than it is in the Ukraine-Russia case. I'm not saying it's irrelevant in the Ukraine-Russia case, but I'm saying that the information war about who's right, who's wrong, the moral dimension, the humanitarian dimension of the Gaza war is much more central to who's actually achieving their political ends in that war. So you might argue, or some argue, that, you know, Israel is doing an excellent job at the tactical and operational level in Gaza. But at the strategic level, you know, where are they headed? What is their end game? I still haven't heard a good answer to that question. I'm not sure if the Israelis have a good answer to that question. It's not even clear to me that they're asking that question.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's in part about the informational dimension of that war. So I hope that at least touched on some of the aspects of the nature of war and how it's changing.
It absolutely did. Thank you. And as I'm listening to you, I'm drawing some parallels to industry, right? The landscape of conflict and competition in industry. And just wondering if I see the asymmetry beginning to become more of a pronounced strategy in industry as well. As an example, is agentic AI a new weapon in that asymmetric strategy in industry? What are some of the parallels that you see in your kind of the industrial base, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just give, maybe this speaks to your question. I'll just give a quick example on the AI space. If we look at DeepSeek, right, versus the Anthropic systems or the most expensive systems that OpenAI and some of the frontier AI firms have developed, mm-hmm. right? That is a perfect example, I would say, of asymmetry in terms of DeepSeek saying, okay, we're not going to necessarily have the best AI, but we're going to figure out a way to get 80, 90% of the way there in terms of capability that we can offer with lower costs, with less training, with less electricity requirements, right? And beat the competition, not in terms of overall quality, but beat the competition in terms of speed of development and costs.
Right.
Right. So that's a great example of kind of how I would argue the Chinese are thinking about competition with the U.S. in industry and how that's analogous to how they're thinking about competition with the U.S. in terms of the military. Those are completely consistent in terms of we don't need the best technology. We don't need the best military technology. This idea of having a qualitative military edge is a term used in the Defense Department. It's this idea of having essentially the military technology that is the best in the world, right? I think that is being replaced by a concept that I'm starting to develop about sustainable military edge. How do you create power at lower cost than your competitors such that you can sustain that creation and maintenance of power over time? So that's kind of a industry example. I would say that there are other examples, but that's the one that comes to mind right now in terms of this asymmetry in the private sector space.
Yeah, thank you. Great example. And I know that our listeners are all very well attuned to kind of this landscape of opportunity and conflict and kind of navigating that themselves. So thank you for that. A lot of our listeners, just by the nature of, you know, the work that we do with NASA and others, we spend a lot of time thinking about the space economy. This the space economy gives us a really great opportunity to think about just an incredible new kind of economic landscape, exploration landscape, almost on a white page basis. right? It's been largely, it's fairly nascent in terms of its kind of industrial development. So as we think about the space economy as another kind of commercial example, actually commercial and public sector example, it involves everything from satellite, internet to asteroid mining, potentially with supply chains and partnerships spanning multiple nations, right? How do geopolitical risks manifest in commercial space operations? And given the landscape, what frameworks do you think will help organizations assess and mitigate some of these interconnected, interdependent risks? A lot of our listeners are space entrepreneurs, right? Trying to navigate that landscape.
Yeah, no. So another great question, and I want to resonate with those listeners who are trying to navigate that landscape. So a few things I would say in terms of this dimension, in this domain of competition, both in the private and public sector. I would say, at least on the U.S. side, and Diane, correct me if I'm wrong, that we've seen a movement towards the private sector becoming the technological leader in
right.
space exploration or space, the capability to reach low and higher Earth orbits and get equipment and people into near and far space. So I'd say that in turn reflects our larger geopolitical trend, which I call a polypolarity. So you probably heard a lot about how, you know, is it a unipolar world? Is it a multipolar world? Is it a bipolar world? I think that debate kind of misses the fact that the types of poles we're talking about have fundamentally changed in geopolitics. So what do I mean by that? I mean, for instance, you probably remember this, that the poles are changing. And they're moving into different domains. So private sector actors are becoming very, very powerful. So you may remember the example of Starlink in Ukraine. Yes. There was a point where Elon Musk, so one individual, mm-hmm. was making a decision about whether or not to continue the telecommunicative space-based internet capability for Ukraine.
It was such a remarkable moment.
It was. That is, you know, and so what I see happening in geopolitics, particularly on the U.S. side, is individuals and corporations are taking on the decision space traditionally left to governments. So traditionally, yeah. we've had governments going to the moon and financing those operations. Now we have private sector basically monopolizing that. I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I have not heard much about major multi-mission NASA-based operations recently. And I hear a lot about SpaceX. I hear a lot about Bezos and his financing of space and reaching space and using technology to right. Start to take over and take advantage of that area, that domain. So that, and then also individuals within those corporations have tremendous amounts of power, and such that, you know, these are not democratically accountable organizations. And they're, in terms of their wealth and their power, I wouldn't say that they rival states. So if you compare state revenue generally on average to, you know, the richest corporations, the wealthiest states are still orders of magnitude wealthier in terms of revenue and being right. able to pool resources than the wealthiest corporations. But over time, I think that is going to start to change, and you're going to see individuals and corporations have a lot more say in governance and in how to regulate, manage, and prevent or allow access to key geopolitical nodes in the system. And that Starlink example, I think, is a great one. Is it? And I think a lot of people, you know, they heard about it and it kind of got lost in the noise. But to me, that was a pivotal moment because if Elon Musk had gone a different way, that would have fundamentally altered the dynamics on the battlefield for Ukraine, at least in the short to midterm, until it found some sort of telecommunications alternative. And I'm not technologically adept enough to know if they could have stood up that infrastructure and how long that would have taken. But it would have definitely disrupted Ukraine operations and been a huge detriment to their ability to defend their country. And that's one, again, one private sector individual. So that's the type of risk that I don't think we saw during the Cold War, a type of risk that we didn't see certainly in the early to mid 20th century or the 19th century. So this is where we see, individuals and corporations becoming powerful. And again, I'm not equating them with states, but powerful enough such that they become relevant geopolitical actors.
Completely.
And they have to
agree.
Take into account. You can't ignore them as just subnational actors that are controlled and managed by states.
Completely agree. I think another fascinating example was Elon's move with the purchase of Twitter, right? And conversion to X.
Yes.
And the policy decisions that he undertook in that transition as well.
Yes.
Shifted the landscape of dialogue.
Yes.
In this nation, right? And I think that had a tremendous effect.
Yes.
I think you're exactly right. We've been talking to the folks that we advise. We've been having a lot of really great conversations about the nature of this balance between the public and private sector and how that is evolving and perhaps how that should evolve. Given the digital era, the infrastructure, the data, the connectivity infrastructure upon which we all sit, it just changes the power dynamic and the operating model, if you will. I'd love to.
Yeah. So I just back to your example of Elon buying Twitter. So one way of understanding that is kind of from a traditional, I would say non-complex systems way, is just understanding him buying a new entity to maximize profit. But another way of understanding that is he doesn't really care how profitable Twitter, now X, is. Mm-hmm. What he cares about is the power it gives him in terms of controlling the information space, right? That is priceless, right? That allows him a lot more influence within the complex system that is the domestic politics of the US, but also you could argue globally, such that it gives him a lot more options for other business ventures.
Right.
So I think your point is well taken, is understanding how that gives him a lot of power in terms of shaping the narrative in a way that benefits him.
Exactly right. And actually perfect segue into my next question for you. So you've mentioned that the interconnections between the elements are often more important than the individual components themselves, right? So can you provide any maybe other specific examples regarding how this plays out in operations, in markets, in the geopolitical landscape where mission success depends on the complex webs of international relationships, technological dependencies, and operational coordination?
Yes. So great, great question again. So let me contrast again, kind of the traditional non-complex systems way of thinking about geopolitics with the complex systems kind of 21st century way of thinking about it. So traditionally in geopolitics, there was a lot of focus on specific geographical areas, particularly Eurasia with all its resources, and also because it's centrally located, and also because of its connection to Europe and its vastness. Okay, so it was called the heartland. Okay, and this is why, even one of the key geopolitical risk firms, Eurasia Group, is called Eurasia Group, because Eurasia was considered kind of the center of the geopolitical chessboard. So it was about this kind of control of stocks. If you're thinking about stocks versus flows, right? I would, just to piggyback on what you're saying, Diane, I would say that is outdated for today. right?
Yeah.
That it's not about control of particular geographic areas. Today's geopolitical heartland, to answer your question, isn't a particular commodity or a particular place. It's about not control of, but connections to flows. So instead of control of stocks, it's about connections to flows. So I'll give you an example. So Marco Rubio recently gave a speech, and there was a, it was in June. I think it was at the American Compass Institute. And he had a little throwaway line in there about how in the negotiations with China about tariffs and other areas of disagreement, rare earths came up. And the U.S. basically had to back down geopolitically because of rare earths. Now, is that because China controls the rare earth commodities themselves? No, it's not because of that. It's because China controls, and there's a great article recently in Foreign Affairs about this, it's because China controls the technological stack that allows not just the extraction of rare earths, but also their processing and also their distribution to the global economy. Okay? So it's not about just having control over a particular place. It's about having connections to the flows. And by flows, I mean the flows of commodities into a processing system, and then that processing system going into distribution, and then that feeding industry, and then those industries creating products. So that's a whole right technological stack. And if you can, the more pieces of that technological stack you control in geopolitics today, the more powerful you're going to be. So in that particular instance, China was really able, because it's over the years, it's cornered the market in terms of processing, refining, and extracting and distributing these rare earths. And if you don't have, for a lot of the most high-end products, for instance, semiconductors and other technological products, if you don't have access to these rare earths, you can't manufacture those products. Yes. Right? And there's no right now, and I'm not saying this isn't going to change, and I think the U.S. now judging is probably moving to figure out, okay, how can we develop alternative access venues, alternative flows, so we're not so dependent on China. But right now, it's cornered the market, and it's developed that over a decade or more. That's not something you can develop, you know, you say strategically, okay, we need to control this technological stack. Let's ramp up those capabilities to control that stack in the next month or year. No, that's not how you have to think. You have to be thinking long-term about which technological stacks are going to be most important, and then how to corner and develop those technological stacks over time. So that's kind of a real interesting example. And Rubio was pretty transparent. Like he didn't act like it was anything other than the fact that they really had to back down because of this particular connection to this particular flow of resources, and they had to maintain that connection for, at least for the time being, and had to back down with respect to China. So,
yeah, it's such a profound point that you just made. And for our listeners, I just really want to take a minute or two to foot stomp this one. Really, it's the paradigm shift for the folks that we work with, moving from traditional operating models, which were very productivity focused, very product focused, to your point, now to operating models that recognize and navigate efficiently in this interconnected world. An ecosystemic operation is much more like kind of an API network, right? So it's the pipes, if you will, of connections and connectors and the nodes, right? It's the systems design that anticipates basically the clusters of value and the vectors of kind of production and distribution and consumption. Nick, for our listeners who are in fact ecosystem orchestrators or designers, whether they're managing international space missions or, you know, developing new technologies, new markets, or just simply, you know, coordinating multi-stakeholder initiatives. What is the most important insight about geopolitical risk dynamics that could help them fundamentally change how they approach stakeholder coordination and strategic planning?
Great question. So one thing I would say is to think about leadership in a different way. So I teach a course on leadership. And one of the things I try to emphasize is this complex systems thinking in terms of leadership. So as you mentioned, use the word design. And I'm not opposed to that. I think you do have to be intentional about the systems and how you create them. But implicit in that verb design, I think, is this idea of kind of hierarchy and kind of ex ante decision making by those at the top. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of how sometimes I think of the word design. I would say one of the things to think about in this context of geopolitics, but also leading organizations within the complex geopolitical ecosystems that we're talking about, is thinking in terms of more bottom-up processes. So thinking about setting conditions for emergent properties to be created that are beneficial to your organization and your strategy, and how to, again, going back to kind of mitigating negative externalities and leveraging positive ones, is thinking about the emergent properties that you want and how to encourage those from the bottom up, and then thinking about the emergent properties that could occur and how to preempt those or mitigate the negative effects of those. Right. And so it's a lot about kind of thinking about stakeholder engagement as not someone at the top, but someone at the center. So again, going back to China, I think China is ahead of the US on this. If you look at their Belt and Road Initiative, you know, a lot of people are focusing on kind of the debt financing and kind of the manipulation of developing economies and their governments. I think you need to kind of step back geopolitically and understand how, you know, China as the Middle Kingdom is thinking about the system from the center rather than thinking about China at the top. I think a lot of people in the U.S. still think about the U.S. being on top. I think that's outdated. I think you have to think about being in the middle. What do I mean by that? I mean that you have to be thinking about how your stakeholders are above you, to the side of you, and yes, below you. And you're not necessarily the one making all the decisions at the top. And then some decisions need to be distributed, and there are good reasons in terms of informational asymmetries and efficiencies for distributing those decisions, but also because the systems themselves are fundamentally different. So, you know, in teaching that leadership course, you know, we look at some of the leadership lessons from the literature from, you know, the 1950s and 1940s. Those organizations, you know, existed in a much more socially homogenous, a much more structured hierarchical social system, where you could make a lot of assumptions about the hierarchy and how to maintain it in the organization and how to compete with other hierarchies. But I think the organizations that are thriving today and the leaders that are managing risk and leading their organizations to success are the ones where the leaders are thinking about themselves at the center rather than at the top, and thinking about how to influence and nudge the system, yes, rather than necessarily design it holistically. Because that's the thing about complex system. You can design a complex system that's great for the next, you know, few days, but the system itself is changing around you such and so dynamically that you're just going to have to redesign it.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to build in the adaptability into the system such that it's redesigning itself organically over time. And as a leader, you're structuring that. I think you used the term, what was it? Structured serendipity in the last. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thinking about kind of how do you structure that serendipity into the complex system so that the emergent properties you want come through and are emphasized and reinforced, and the emergent properties that you don't want are mitigated and lessened.
So brilliant. So brilliant. And you're exactly right. The ecosystemic models are just really good at creating this this gravity well, if you will, around the missions that matter, and then very good at sensing and sense making, and to your point, adapting and nudging and in directions of goodness, and making sure that that value is optimized across that system and for the individual actors within those systems. And I hate to say this, but we are at the top of the hour and we'll probably need to wrap it at that. Nick, this has been a fascinating discussion. I'd love to reserve the right to come back and continue this conversation at some point.
Of course. But, I'd love to.
Yeah, no, I thank you for the opportunity to share your perspective with our community, but then also to really learn from your experience. It's just love the work that you're leading and the journey that you've been on. So we'll certainly follow you in your digital wake and keep an eye on the fascinating journey that you're on. So thank you, Nick.
You're certainly welcome. And thank you for your excellent questions. Those are great questions, Diane.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our listeners, thank you. As always, thank you for joining us today as we have explored how geopolitical intelligence can be reframed through ecosystemic lens to navigate our increasingly complex world and landscape of global partnerships. So as always, please check us out and follow your podcast channels of choice. Check us out on Spotify or Apple, or you can always find more information at shoshimworks.com. Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk again soon.